Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 183, Revealing Your Magic Body with Dr. Nita.
The very famous thing of Tantra, which is the male-female union. Whether you are a yogi or yogini, you have to have a partner because there has to be a mother and a father in union. But it isn't ordinary, and then a lot of people get the wrong idea about Tantra, that it's just some sneaky way for a bunch of horny monks to have sex, which is completely wrong, because actually it's not ordinary sexuality at all, but it is the posture of sexual union, but it is completely different because both partners are at a yogic stage of where they hit the subtle body. And then the reason they are in father-mother union, as it is called, yab-yum, not male-female, but actually father-mother. The reason they are in that union is that this gives them a place to return to their coarse body as a ngakpa, as a siddha, as a shaman. They come back to this, they have to have a mother and a father. And they just like they get reborn back in their own body. There's something in the tradition of Marpa, there's something called the nine mergers, where they merge your, you know, death clear light with the samadhi or sleep clear light and with the enlightenment clear light, you know, that, which is voidness, that means. You have a conscious ability to arise from the subtle plane out of your meat-based body. And that's a John Perry Barlow's expression. The electronic people who live in the internet, when they get back in their ordinary senses and body, they call it meat space, which I like very much, rather than sort of virtual space. So this is actual virtual space. Already from the Tibetan, Indian and Tibetan tradition, yogic tradition, you're in this virtual space where you have what's called the magic body, Maya Deha, the Maya body. And the rude people call it the illusion body. I don't call it illusion, because she's not a, you know, that's the mother of Buddha, it's Maya Devi, the goddess of Maya. So it's magical. But you can call magic illusion. You can call it that. But it's sort of it's a put down, you know. Of course, when you say magic, it means something creative, you know, rather than illusion, something incorrect or unreal, you know. Because it is real on a virtual level, you know, the magic body. So then in the magic body, depending on what you achieved in the creation stage, where you visualize the mandala and yourself as a deity, like a four-armed Avalokiteshvara or a 34-armed Yamantaka or whatever different kind of tantric forms there are, whatever stability you had in meditating yourself in that kind of creation stage, now when you have a body like a dream body, like a lucid dream body, but you're in this trance state in a union, and it doesn't have to be a physical union. You could have what they call an intuition consort, a jnana mudra, you know, and it could be male or female, depending on whether you're male or female or how you're meditating yourself. But in any case, in that stage, you then do a lot of meritorious things. And then in that virtual reality, you also go back down to the clear light and you sort of, in a way, blissfully die out of whatever divine or Buddha body you have, and again come back, and again give your body away, and again come back, and again go through the four blisses, and again give your body back. And come back to your body, to your subtle body. You can do that like you could in a dream. For example, the reason the Bodhisattva takes three incalculable aeons of lifetimes in the exoteric teaching to become a Buddha is that that Bodhisattva has to live and die, and live and die, and live and die in a human, preferably, or divine, or even animal life form, many, many millions of times. And they have to give their life, and give their body, and give their blood, and commit great acts of generosity and patience and tolerance and ethics and meditation and wisdom and so on. And it takes a long time. Each time you die and you're reborn, you got to have a mom and dad, you got to go to school, they've got to bring you up, you have to like wipe your nose, wipe your butt, and then finally you make your bodhisattva achievement in that life, and then you die. And so it takes a long time. But in the magic body practice, or also he's going to talk about Atta Yoga practice, you do all of that in this subtle plane as if you were in a dream. Like you could have a dream in which you lived and died 15 times in a night. And if you got really good at it, you could do it 100 times. Because you're only going out of a coarse, a relatively coarse, virtual body, having a virtual slippage into the infinite, indescribable clear light of the void, and then returning to another one, and returning and returning. And that is how the Vajrayana accelerates the evolutionary process of a being from ordinary level to a Buddha being. Now, I'm not saying I know for sure that even this can happen, but this is their technology, this is their system, this is what the great siddhas of India and the Buddha in teaching the Vajrayana. This is the kind of super subtle, highly accelerated. It's like an internal genetic engineering of an altruistic, completely enlightened being. Okay, so now the fourth stage, after the magic body stage, when you've achieved that ability, which is of course way beyond me, but I'm just following what they say about it, you come to what's called the fourth stage of the five stages of perfection, which is called the stage of, it's called Abhisambodhi, manifest enlightenment. It's sometimes called clear light stage. And because there the emphasis is again on plunging your virtual magic body again and again into clear light of the void, again and again plunging into it, again and again, and then rising up out of it and plunging into it. So that's, so because the sort of deep instinctual, self-centered, I'm a being opposed to everything else, all of these instincts, you're working through them at the super subtle, super subconscious level. You become conscious of the super subconscious. And you're no longer, by finally Buddhahood, you have no unconscious. You're conscious of every level yourself, from the subatomic particle, from the quantum, indescribable Copenhagen Declaration level of untheorizable and unquantifiable reality, up to the level of meat space. That's what a Buddha is capable of doing. So much so that then they have this preposterous thing for materialists, but not for us Buddhists, where a being who's a Buddha can manifest simultaneously hundreds of bodies, thousands of bodies if necessary. Although I sometimes worry, where is the Buddha's Nirmanakaya, and where was he or she and it when we were voting? Why weren't they casting the vote? That's, I wonder about that. But so I get a little dubious sometimes. But that's the theory, anyway, I'm explaining, okay? So now Nagarjuna describes this fourth stage. He says, I pay homage to the Vajra hero, teacher of universal emptiness. I will explain the fourth stage of manifest enlightenment, that's Abhisambodhi. The original self-existent Lord, the sole great soul deity, greater than him is the Vajra mentor, because he grants the personal instructions. Having truly, Dr. Nida, who was not only a doctor, he is a Vajra mentor, I am not. So actually we're in the presence of one of the Vajra mentors for his disciples, that means. And which I hope to be one. But I don't know, he hasn't accepted me necessarily yet. I'm not sure he's going to accept the professor, I don't know for sure. But I hope so. And then there's a lot of things about how great the Vajra mentor is, but I'm not going to read all of it, because I want to get to him, but I want to read that just enough to have touched on it. The luminances should be generated, striving with the enlightenment spirit. And this is the initiatory thing. Place them in the vase, and the mentor out of love at midnight consecrates the good disciple at midnight. Having truly gotten the consecration in the pre-dawn light again, the disciple folds one's palms to please the mentor with worship and praise. And here, this is, then, as those of you who are new here don't know that, the moonlit space, sunlit space, and the darklit space are these three, luminance, radiance, and immanence, or those are called the three luminances. Even the black one, the dark one, is a black luminance. And then the clear light is this gray twilight, like transparency is really a better translation than clear light, because it's not a brightness that has shadows, casts shadows, and has the opposite of darkness. The brightnesses are at the subtle mind level of sun and moon. but the, and the darkness is its opposite. But the clear light is both bright and dark simultaneously. That's why it's indescribable, because it's both brilliant and it's both pitch black. So they make analogy, pre-dawn twilight is the time of the clear light of the void, you know, only to be realized through the melting of the great bliss, what they call the Mahasukha. So anyway, then the disciple, after receiving that consecration, prays the Guru mentor. He says, I pay homage to you, the unconditional, liberated from the three realms, which are the realm of matter, the pure matter of desire, realm of pure matter, and realm of matter, immaterial realm. Enlightened, equanimous as the space, not corrupted by all desires. I pay homage to you, the unconditional, not dependent on the aggregates, that's the body-mind complex, not on the elements and nor the media, those are the sense spheres, you know, but liberated from all mistakes. I pay homage to you, the unconditional, free of concepts and imaginations, your mind free of fixed abode, your mind utterly inconceivable, whose mind is like open space without fabrication or corruption. I pay homage to you, the unconditional. Grant the vision of direct enlightenment, whose nature is universal emptiness. And the disciple, now this is because, it's very interesting, the highest of the initiations is called the word initiation. And it's beyond the initiation of the consort and this, or the Vaz initiation, the secret initiation, the wisdom intuition initiation, which are the first three, although sometimes those are unpacked into a whole number. But the most powerful one is the word one. And the word one is received just by hearing the word. That, like, you are, you know, clear light, you are Buddha in clear light, etc. Male, female, whatever. Whatever the word, you are Guhya Samaja, you are great perfection, you are whatever you are, Vajradhara. So it's just hearing the word in that time of the subtle plane, because the word is what, it's mantra, and the word creates in a way that state. So it's the hearing of that word, it's very, very interesting. So then the guru, the mentor, as I like to call it, I don't like the word master so much. I mean, there is such a thing, but the problem with master is master has to have a slave. Whereas mentor has a disciple, and it's sort of a little lighter. You know, it isn't quite as heavy as the guru word. But the master is not wrong, of course. So then one asks, and this is after midnight and after this and that. It says, great protector, grant me the vision of direct enlightenment, free from evolution and birth, abandoning the three illuminations. So beneath those three lights and darkness. Great mentor, grant to me the great intuition of all Buddhas, the abode of all the transcendent ones, the unexcelled Vajra intuition. And the reason I call it intuition, I just want to say this. This again, other people don't do this. They get wisdom, wisdom, wisdom all the time. You know. But there's two words, prajna, which means like supercritical insight, wisdom. And then jnana, which actually means simply knowledge. But I call it intuition because nobody, no self-centered person can see the clear light. Even Buddha doesn't see the clear light, because Buddha is the clear light, and everything is the clear light. So it's like when you see a reflection in a mirror, all you see is the details of the reflection. The reflection is purely on the surface of the mirror, but simultaneously with your perceiving of all these objects in the mirror, you have an intuition which you don't have to articulate at all, but you have a parallel knowledge that they're just on the surface of a mirror. Right? So the Buddha has a parallel knowledge in dealing with the suffering beings, and still in the relative plane through his emanation body, that he also is all of those beings and is the clear light of the void, like the mirror is the clear light of the void, which is not just, it's not like they're in the mirror or the mirror is under them or behind them or inside them. They are the whole surface and every texture and every configuration and every fiber of every living being and every atom and subatomic energy is the clear light of the void. And so, you know, the eye cannot see itself, you know. The Buddha is a being that has melted completely into that and yet simultaneously, and then holds that intuition and never leaves it, and yet can have wisdoms and knowledges and rainbow light rays and interact with beings who are not as gassed out as he is. Or she is, they're female Buddhas also, right? And they're pretty blissful, aren't they, Gelang? Those Buddhas. And therefore, they're compassionate when they see beings who are like all hung up because they think they're separate from everything, and what's going to happen to me? You know, am I going to go to hell, or am I going to die, or I get sick? And that bliss and that Buddhahood must be somewhere else. and they feel compassionate for such beings. So they interact with it. And then you can't bomb them into bliss. Even you are a vast cloud of bliss. You can't bomb people into bliss. Because some paranoid person, if they suddenly think that bliss is coming at them from every direction, or even from inside them, they're going to have a freak out. They're going to think the alien is taking rebirth in their stomach or something. Or that someone is smothering them with energy. Right? So then the skillful art form of Buddhahood shows all kind of these emanation bodies and mystical bodies and things like that. Okay? So that's why I call it intuition. Because people who say, oh, I saw emptiness yesterday, they're making a mistake. Because you can't see emptiness. Because right now this is emptiness. But we're seeing the things, because the emptiness doesn't get in the way of the things. Doesn't destroy them. There's no like emptiness that's somewhere else. This is emptiness. Right now. Right here, tip of your own nose. Okay? So it's an intuition, however, that it's emptiness, since it looks like somebody's nose. Okay. So then he says, grant to me the great Vajra. And Vajra means that clear light of the void. Diamond, it means. The great Vajra. Beginningless and endless peace. Purifying all afflictions. Purifying body, speech, and mind. And beginningless is very important, because whenever you realize that, you realize you always were there. It's not a new insight to you. It's not a new thing. You don't go into a new place. You realize you were always in that place. If you remember when Buddha attains enlightenment, and the other of you, I've been harping on this for many, many classes, but those of you who weren't here, I'm just filling you in. You know, remember when Buddha under the Bodhi tree achieved perfect enlightenment first, at the same moment, really, he remembered infinite previous lives, and then he became aware of everybody else's infinite previous lives. And then that sort of just phased it, so he was everywhere in every moment of time and space. Then he was aware of everybody else's future lives. And then he was everywhere in time, and time as well as space, which was then the final nirvana, where he melted to bliss into clear light of the void. So then he does that. Then they, I have to skip. And then the Noble One proclaims the ultimate and primal occurrences, or centerless occurrences, or central occurrences, or limitless occurrences, or limited occurrences. All these are universal emptiness, where there is no going and no coming, no ending and no increasing, no thing and no non-thing, wondrous in form yet not wondrous, not abiding and not passing quickly, what is free of all conventions of existence and non-existence, with no form of merit or sin, supreme without any nature of merit or sin, the Buddhas proclaim that all of these are universal emptiness. The yogi attains thus such reality, gaining the inexhaustible body of the sole friend of beings, whose nature is animate and inanimate, the human lion of the nature of intuition, the cause of all beings. The crooked body becomes straight, firm, and abiding without any abode, whose eyes are wide open even when they are closed, who is entranced even when not meditating, even though one uses words, one is inexpressible, though one has pleasures, one has no grasping, though one is savior of the world, one is the slave of others. Who realizes reality ends all faults, the disciple who has gotten the instruction trains in these two, so there's some other things. Okay, so I don't want to go on too long because I want to get a lot of space. But anyway, all is accomplished by universal emptiness. The spirit of enlightenment, that means love and compassion of the Bodhisattva spirit, is called the absolute. So this is absolute relativity. And one receives this sort of initiatorily from the mentor, and by that word, somehow the transmission of that word from one who themselves is the manifestation of that clear light, then the yogi becomes the clear light. Then there's the fifth stage, which is the stage of communion, where in the stage of communion, I call it communion. Other people call it I call it communion, although I know that the Pope Francis might feel disturbed. But the point is that union is sort of seems like it doesn't necessarily emphasize the idea that there's still the pair of things. The Tibetan word sungjuk, or yuganada in Sanskrit, the yuga part means a pair, and the nada means united. But they're still each, so they're both one, and yet they're individually enjoying being one. So it's like it has that calm, and the Latin calm means together. So calm union means two things, two beings together in union. At least two, you know. So that's why I think it's the perfect word for sungjuk, which is the tantric expression for Buddhahood. I pay homage to the Savior, whose nature is cause and effect, yet abandons all duality. I will explain the final stage of communion. Abandoning the two notions of samsara and nirvana, wherein they become the same thing, that is called communion. So communion, the state of communion, like a Buddha, nirvana and samsara are same. So they never leave. That's the key point. Buddhas don't leave. Shakyamuni Buddha is still here. Yutok Yonden Gombo is still here. Padmasambhava is still here. Tsongkhapa is still here. They never leave. They seem to leave a coarse body to teach impermanence to some types of beings. But on the plane of their what's called Sambhogakaya, their body of beatitude, of perfect bliss, they're always present completely. Because they're, and the poor guys or girls, they're one with us in all of our problems. They are actually permeate us. All Buddhas do. They're in every atom of every cell because we are made of that kind of clear light. So when abandoning the two notions of samsara and nirvana, wherein they become the same thing, that is called communion. Knowing the addictive and the purificative, both as the absolute itself, who knows them as just the same, knows the communion. The notion of things with their forms and the notion of nothingness. The yogi or yogini who treats them as the same, that one knows this communion. Who abandons the cognitions of permanence and annihilation, that one is the sage who knows the reality of this stage of abiding communion. Knowing wisdom and compassion as one who acts in such a way is said to have communion. So it goes on. I don't want to read all of it. It's all in that vein. And in a way, my view is this is kind of the new translation school's way of expressing Ati Yoga, what they call. It's their way of saying it. So it's where both traditions, the old translation school and the new translation school, meet in communion beyond terms of old and new. And I think that's very important to avoid sectarianism, that people are aware of that, that's my personal view. So then finally he says, this is the non-dual intuition, the unlocated nirvana. It is the Buddha Vajrasattva himself or herself, Mrs. Vajrasattva, Vajradhatu Ishvari, and the Lord Mentor of all. The heroic march samadhi, the form of the man of great knowledge, the Vajra-like samadhi, the abode of the stage of perfection, the magical illusion-like or magical samadhi, and non-duality, all are said to be it. Whatever expressions such as unborn or birthlessness, which teach the non-dual intuition, all of them are expressions of this. There no other is explained. The Buddhas, quite as numerous as the sands of the Ganga River, realize this very thing, and abandoning being and nothingness, attain the essence of the great seal, or what I like to translate, the great embrace. The great yogi who is training, abiding in the state of communion, by meditation on that communion, one's deeds are non-dual from that. As is oneself, so one's enemy. As is one's wife, so a demoness. As is a courtesan, so one's mother. As is a Brahmin, so a washerman. As is one's skin, so one's clothes. As is chaff, so a jewel. As is wine, so urine. As is food, so excrement. As in sweet-smelling camphor, so the smell of excrement. As is the speech of praise, so the speech of contempt. Such a terrific Vajri considers day and night the same. As Rahu, so Vajradhara. As dreamlike things he sees, destruction being as like being at ease, happiness like suffering, anger like love, hell like heaven, evil and good as just alike. So knowing, the intuitive one, without hesitation, does everything, achieving all by the hidden discipline, attaining all perfections. This supreme fifth stage, by the merit gained from teaching it, may the whole world sport with this samadhi of communion. So that's Nagarjuna, anyway. So that's like the Dawa, you know, Thakomjo. Yes. Anyway, now Gela, please tell us the Thakomjo Sum of your Ati Yoga.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded at the Force for Good class series happening at Tibet House US in New York City and online. It was recorded earlier this year in spring of 2018 when Professor Thurman was joined by Dr. Nita for a talk on Dr. Nita's book, Ati Yoga, The Mirror of Light. The two of them discuss the different stages of meditation, and if you're inspired by what you hear here, we'll be posting the full archive of this recording later on this week as a podcast bonus. You'll also be able to view clips from this retreat on the Tibet House US YouTube channel. The full archive recording is now available in the Tibet House member archives, which can be viewed at tibethouse.us. Full access begins at $2 to monthly supporters and all current members of Tibet House US. The second half of this week's podcast will be Dr. Nita talking about how the magic body relates to Ati Yoga and his writings in his new book. His new books on the Dzogchen method of meditation and philosophy of Tibetan Buddhism, Mind Training. We'll provide a link to the book and information about Dr. Nita, including upcoming programs at Menla, at Tibet House, and any other public teachings he's offering in New York City and during his West Coast and Portland, Oregon tour. If there's one Tibetan teacher that you make time for in your schedule in the next year, Dr. Nita is someone I suggest highly. He's one of my main teachers and a deep inspiration for me and all my friends who have worked with him and have read his teachings. Be sure to visit our podcast archives for several episodes, including Revealing Your Rainbow Body with Dr. Nita from an event he did at Menlo with Dr. Thurman about 2 years ago. There'll be a link in the podcast description to find that episode. This week's episode was brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and Menlo Retreat located in Phoenicia, New York. If you're looking to deepen your practice, get away from the city, or rent a space to bring your teacher to your community in the New York area, be sure to check out Menlo Retreat and Dewa Spa, located just 2 hours north of New York City in the heart of the Catskills. It's one of my favorite places and definitely worth the visit. Great programs in 2018 include Dr. Nita, Dr. Issa, and a special New Year's program with Sharon Salzberg. Be sure to RSVP early to the New Year's retreat for Dr. Nita's October program. Space is limited and it's definitely worth investing the time. And as always, the weekly interstitial music for the Bob Thurman podcast is provided by Tenzin Chogyal, used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzin Chogyal, visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode with Bob and Dr. Nita.
Okay, Gala, your turn.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Ati Yoga. Thank you very much. Tujichena. I think Professor already mentioned about Sutrayana and then Tantrayana or Vajrayana. So we have Sutra and Tantra, and then according to the old school, then we have this Dzogchen. Mm-hmm. It's called the Mahasanti Yana. So there are three yanas. And Sutra Yana's main philosophy is the renunciation. So more it's a monastic tradition, right? Mm-hmm. So monastic tradition. So the main philosophy is how to renounce, right, or how to avoid the causes of the sufferings or the problems. So that's why Buddha is always suggesting to become monks and nuns, right? Then you never get, you don't need to get divorced and fighting with couples and having troubles with the kids, right? So that's the best suggestion according to Sutrayana. To become a monk or to become a nun, then your life is cool. And then Tantrayana is more about transformation, so transforming the negative emotions into... Tantrayana is more like, in the Western tradition, is alchemy, you know? It's an inner alchemy, so how we can transform the negative emotions into positive emotions, or the negative emotions into the wisdom. And then in the old school, we are talking about three types of yogas. So these three types of yogas, they are kind of called Dzogchen, the great perfection. And first yoga is called Maha Yoga. And second yoga is called the Anu Yoga. And this yoga, this my book, this is about Ati Yoga. Okay, Maha Yoga means the great yoga. And Anu Yoga?
Anu Yoga is corresponding yoga, maybe, something like that. La. Anu, following. Anu.
Following yoga.
Sequential yoga.
Maha Yoga, Anu Yoga, and then we have Ati Yoga, three yogas. Okay? So in the Indian tradition, when we say yoga, it's more referred to physical exercises. But in Tibetan tradition, when we say yoga, the meaning of yoga is the ultimate state. So yoga can be like the body yoga, and the energy yoga or speech yoga, and also can be mind yoga. So mind meditation, that's also known as yoga. So we meditate, the goal of the meditate is to understand the true nature of mind. Okay, so that's why we need this mind yoga. And then we do energy work or chanting mantras and doing prayers and breathing exercise, the one we did before. Those are all called like energy or speech yoga. To do this in order to understand or achieve the ultimate state of our energy. And then we do physical yoga, like this Vajra posture, and there are many other postures, but this is one of the best, you know, these postures, and to try to understand the true nature of our human body. So in this case, we call human body, it's called the Vajra body, the diamond body, or the indestructible body. So that's why when we say yoga, you know, it can be three meanings. It can be the physical one, or the breathing one, or the chanting one, or the meditating one, okay? But these three yogas, Maha Yoga, Anu Yoga, and Ati Yoga, they are more referred, how do you say, to our mind, okay? In a very simple way, Maha Yoga, it's an antidote for anger. Maha Yoga is antidote anger. Who has short temper? Who are the short-tempered ones? Only few, wow, only few. Only few people. Xiaomin, you're not short-tempered? Okay, okay.
I used to.
All right, so in a very simple way, these three yogas are targeted in three different personalities, right? So the first group of people, they are short-tempered people, angry people.
Kontrotsapo, karasegir.
Kontrotsapo, irritable. Irritable
group.
Very like.
Okay, so if you are irritable or if you are short-tempered, you should practice Maha Yoga. That's your yoga, okay? And then the second group is group with desire, strong desires. And then that practice is called Anu Yoga. And, you know, desire for eating chocolate, sweet, pasta, spaghetti. And there are many other desires, right? Who are in this desire group? Okay, who like to eat sweet? You don't like to eat sweet?
Once in a while.
Okay, so desire group. That's called Anu Yoga, okay? And then the third group is the group, confused group.
Yeah.
Ati Yoga.
Ati Yoga. Timuk.
Timuk.
Or, confused the group. So if you don't like that confused, you know, the word, we can say also stupid group. Or another word is called the ignorant group.
Oh,
yeah. Okay? All right, so that's the final group. There are no other groups. Angry groups and desire group and confused group. Okay, who are in the confused group? Who are in confused group? There are more people. Okay, that's very good. And if you think you have all of them, you're in the confused group. Okay? But you say, I have a little bit this one, that one, oh, also this one. Okay, the last group. Confused group. Okay? So that's the target of Ati Yoga. Okay? So the Ati, it's a Sanskrit word. The Ati, it's a Sanskrit word. It means, there are many translations, but I like this word of extreme. Ati Yoga means extreme yoga. Okay, extreme yoga. Why it's extreme? Because it's extremely simple. Okay? Extremely simple. That's why it's called Ati Yoga, right? So, because we are all confused, you know? And the best antidote for confusion is simplicity, right? And so that's why Ati Yoga, Shintu, Shintu. Tibetan they call Shintu. Shintu means also like very, really like this, but I like this English word, extreme, extreme simple. So in that sense, it's Ati Yoga means the extremely, extreme simple yoga, okay? Like the yoga posture, right? If you learn the Indian yoga, there are so many yoga postures. You know, you can learn like so many different, hundred of different yoga postures, the standing one and sitting one, stretching one, right? There are so many of them. And the same way, also if you learn Tibetan Tsalung or Yantra Yoga, there are many, many postures. Ati Yoga says you just do this Vajra posture and that's enough. It's simple, right? I showed you once and now you know how to do it. You know, now you don't need to go to a yoga studio. Now you know how to do it, right? It looks like do we have a Vajra here? You know the Vajra symbol, right? Vajra symbol. So this upper part of Vajra, if you stay like this, is the lower part of Vajra. Like this.
Oh, yeah,
so you
like
can
this,
do that.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
You can do that standing, you can do that sitting, you can do that lying down, on the back, on the belly, just one posture, okay? So that's about Ati Yoga. And if we talk about physical, body part, it's very simple because there's just one posture. And this one posture eliminates 72,000 blockages of our channels. All right, so we have so many channels in our body, and this posture will eliminate all blockages in our body. And this, mentally also the meditation itself, Ati Yoga, it's very simple, you know, right? There are many, of course, if we talk about Anumaha Yoga, the meditation is a little bit complicated, you know. So I think you can see many like the wrathful deities, you know, the Tibetan wrathful deities, right? In the entrance, there's a big one, the red one. So when you see that image, how do you feel that?
Great. Empowered. You might.
Okay. So that's the expression of human anger. Do you understand? You should not see that, that it's an art. That's just expression of our inner emotions, right? And especially the red ones, you know, the red ones. Why it's a red? Because it's fire. Mm-hmm. Right? It's an expression. When you are really, really angry, what do you do? How do you shout?
You become red.
Yeah, you become red, right? How do you shout? Somebody can shout? When you are really angry.
Get red in the face. Yeah. Turns red.
Red in the face, right? So you see, if you look, now you know that, you know, now you should look at one of these very wrathful, fierceful image. And then you see, that's your mirror, that's your reflection. When you are angry, exactly like that, right? The moment you're angry, you don't have a mirror, you don't see yourself, right? So that's why, how do you say, we don't recognize this, our own, inner emotions. But now if you see one of these images, that's exactly the image while you're angry. Okay? So Mahayoga says, we, according to this Mahayoga teaching, we should not deny our emotions. We should not repress and suppress our emotions. If you're angry, you should get anger come out. All right? And so how you can make the anger come out? That's a question. So normal, our normal anger, when we really get angry, right? We harm other people, right? We are so angry and this and that, you know, you use bad words and this, then other people get hurt. And then later we feel bad too, right? So if you don't shout and if you don't express your anger in front of those people, and then you suffer because you keep that volcano inside. And so this volcanic force is there. So that's called the stress. You're holding the anger, right? That's called the stress. You see? So normally we have two choices. Or we are going to harm other people, or you harm ourselves, right? But Mahayoga says there is a third solution. What is third solution? You express your anger while you are meditating. You are alone. Nobody is next to you. Nobody is next to you. But you make yourself really angry and let your all anger force, the force of anger, come out. And then you become like the deity, like Yamantaka. We have here Yamantaka.
Yeah,
right?
There's two big Yamantakas.
There's a Yamantaka. Okay? And so you are meditating, but you are mentally, you really imagine you becoming Yamantaka. Or Hayagriva, all these fearful ones. Okay? So Tibetan Vajrayana, if you see really closely, it's a perfect, psychotherapy. I call it the one of the best self-psychotherapy. If you know how to do these sadhana meditations and these things, that's the perfect meditation, right? You see, for some people, these restful practices, it doesn't work because maybe your nature is not a fire element. You are more like water or more like earth, right? More earth and water is attachment, desire. And if your nature is a fire, and then this kind of meditation, it works very well, right? You have a tanka, you have a restful Buddha image, and imagine that's your image, and you are releasing your anger, you are releasing your pressure, stress, everything, right? So you're helping yourself because you release everything. You are not harming anyone because nobody sees, you know. Nobody receives that you are bad, the anger vibration. All right, so that's called the Mahayoga. That's called the Mahayoga. I think Professor explained that part as a generation stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I call it creation stage.
Creation stage. Okay, mm-hmm. You recreate yourself. Right? You recreate yourself. The wrathful deity, it shows 100% of expression of human anger. Right? 100%. Is if you look at the deities, the eyes and their nose and their teeth and their muscles, everything. Like this. You do this meditation again and again. You know, after meditation you are so tired, so you never get angry. Right? So it really works. And then the second meditation is called the desire. And then again, like Professor mentioned earlier, this union the Buddhas, right? You see some union the Buddhas. So that's the symbol of human desire. So we have so many different kind of desires. Desires of eating sweet, desire, what's your desire? Show me. Desire of making more money and exactly. See, so we have so many different kind of desires, right? Actually, our life is based on like endless desires, desire and desire. We need this one and that one, right? Our life is based on the desires. And one of the strongest desire is human sexual desire. And so somehow that's why this union Buddha, that's the message of our desire. But again, the problem is we don't know how to handle that desire, right? We don't know how to handle. That's the problem. We don't know how to handle anger. Vajrayana is saying, Vajrayana doesn't say anger is something bad, you know, right? Anger, it's called a poison. It's a poison. Poison is not negative. Poison means simply dangerous, right? But the poisons, if you know how to use them, they are good medicines. You know all antibiotics, right? Antibiotics, they are all poisons. But if you know when you use antibiotics, for what you use, and you know how many times you use, it's a medicine, right? So especially in chemical medicine, we see this example perfectly. It is a medicine, and same time also it's a poison, right? So that's why Vajrayana says all these our inner emotions, they are like kind of poisons. If you know how to use them, you know, we can use them in a very good way, right? Antibiotics, they are poisons, you take it and, you know, your infection is get cured, right? So if you refuse antibiotics saying it's a poison, there can be a danger of your life, right? That's very easy to understand, right? I think this is the reason today there are so many people, they try to refuse antibiotics. Okay, so that's exactly similar. So many people, they try to refuse their anger, but it doesn't work. Or the anger harm others, or the anger can harm ourselves, right? And recently there are many research saying that anger can cause a heart attack. You know, some people, they don't show their anger. All of us, we have anger, but they don't express much. They are always keeping, and they are likely to have heart attacks, right? And many people, they die with that. So if anger causes the heart attack and kills somebody, of course, that's a poison, right? That's a very bad poison. And so we don't know how to handle that poison, and that's why this Mahayoga says, meditate on the wrathful deities. Wrathful deities, you know, you are imagining you are the wrathful deities, and also when we are angry, we use bad words, and then you chant the mantras. Some mantras are like hulu hulu, for example. Hulu hulu, hana hana. Right? These are the expression of like anger, how do you say, the anger speech. Hulu hulu has no meaning. Hana hana has no meaning, but it's a way to express our anger, right? How do you say when you are really angry in American English? Eric, how do you say?
You say fuck you.
Huh?
That's New York.
That's so soft. And he's smiling as if fuck you.
That's New York.
You see the speech and expression doesn't match, right? Because he's not saying that fuck you in from of his like deep dimension, you know? Right? Otherwise, when you use that word, like that, right? Okay, so that's about Mahayoga. And then the Anu Yoga is more about desire, you know, how to work with the desire. And also, again, the visualization of the deities. You know, some deities, like Vajra Yogini, and there are some deities, they are also kind of, how do you say, sexy?
Yes.
Can I say that?
Sexy, sure.
Uh-huh.
Attractive.
Attractive.
Seductive.
Magnetizing these deities. So if you read this text, they explain very, very, very clearly. If you do really according to that, we can release very easily this our desire, you know. We can really easily process our all desires, okay? And so we have many desires, but most powerful desire is sexual desire. But when you meditate with this union, the Buddhas and so on, it's a way to process our desire. Okay? And it works. It works. You should try. And then the last one is Ati Yoga is the ignorance. So that's our main problem, right? Ati Yoga is the ignorant. As the Buddha said, there's a Buddha's word. Buddha said, the darkest night. Buddha said, the darkest night is the ignorance. Right? So it's about the darkness. Ignorance is about darkness. And so we get lost in that darkness. It's called confusion, right? And then somehow in that darkness, we see a way, but we don't want to go that way. That's called the stupidity. So in that darkness holds all problems, right? Confusion, stupidity, ignorance. Shanda kariyorila, injike.
No.
Shanda injike la kariyor.
Ignorance, misknowing is my favorite. Misknowing.
Like misknowing.
Misknowledge.
Misknowledge.
Like misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. Misperception.
Okay. They are all in the darkness, their own darkness. And that's the reason.
Delusion also is.
Delusion. Okay? You know all these words, right? So that's like all these things are represented by the darkness. And that's why this my book is called The Mirror of Light. So I like the word, use the word of the light. Actually, the light is, like a professor was saying, is not like this light, you know. One part is shining and one part there's a shadow or dark and like this. So it's like an infinite light, which is saying in Adi Yoga, is saying that's the true nature of ourself.
I'm reading from San Francisco, California, poetry by Go Eun. The unofficial poet laureate of Korea, Go Eun Sung Sunim, is also a Sun Zen priest. Last night, in a dream, I was clinging to far-off Saturn's rings. Hey, little puppy, what did you dream? And the second poem of his is the poem in last night's dream. Look at the bird at the edge of its nest. Look at the bird perched at the edge of its nest and then fly away. After the bird has flown, look at the empty nest, the pure emptiness. Now, look at the gray sky. Commentary by Go Eun. I find myself fascinated by the spiritual traces left by former poets. The dreams of former poets are illuminating. Some poets' vocations begin in their dreams. One poet is said to have borrowed 5 writing brushes of different colors from a dream and wrote poems with them. Then, having restored the brush to its owner in his dream, poems no longer came to him. Left poemless, he could no longer find any reason to go on living, so he quit this world. Recalling the poem upon waking, it is utterly unfamiliar. Some dream poems are very long and so vanish completely once I awake, but mostly they are like this one, only not so long. My brief poems have their roots in my dreams. Imagine a poet composing poems while riding on a donkey's back. Sometimes when he coughs, even his spit will become a poem. Some poets have said they drink poetry. Someone once said, I breathe poetry. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment has been a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. Tashi Delic.